Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Julie, and I am an alcoholic. The joke about the Kleenex is I tend to be a crier. However, different from when I first came in and I was just crying out of hopelessness and desperation. Who won the bet? It's more tears of gratitude for this program. Thank you very much. All right, so my sobriety date is 7/11/2015. And I guess I'll start with birth and move on. However, I will say that my husband has told me I like to tell things from the womb, so I'll try to keep it speeding along. We only have about 45 minutes. I grew up in northern Illinois. I am one of 8 children. And remarkably, I am the only alcoholic in the family. My parents weren't drinkers. I mean, my dad would drink on occasion, probably more so now. He'll have a beer in the evening or whatever. But they weren't big drinkers. I had an uncle who was an alcoholic and a gambler, but as far as I can remember, that's the only real big alcoholism in my family. I would like to say there's some other isms that I think they practice that I've learned in the program here. And somewhere along the line, I guess I picked up on those bad habits and internalized them. I had a pretty normal childhood, had a lot of fun, a lot of big family gatherings. But I think from a young age, I just felt, I don't know, I didn't feel part of, if that makes sense. I didn't feel as engaged as maybe I should have. And then, of course, when I started drinking, that became more profound in my life. Just kind of sitting back on the wing and not really fully participating. I took my first drink when I was 14. I know it was homecoming week. My parents were out of town. Big brother was watching, not too closely, I might add. But I remember drinking a bottle of Jack of Boxy wine. And I drank the whole bottle. Who does that? And what it did for me, man, we got like the munchies, you know? So we drove in town, a little small town. A little bowling alley, got chicken and who knows what. We went back to the house. I wasn't driving at the time, but my sister was. And so we just, it went in spurts during my high school career. I was very involved in sports, band, sports band, school, pom-poms, or drill team. We weren't the cheerleaders. We knew about the cheerleaders. They had a reputation, So I was better than that. But I was a pom-pom girl. And, when I got my license, then we could go out and, I used to drink like slow gin fizzes. Oh, anybody? Yeah, thank you. That's like, what is that stuff they put in the stuff my kids get at the restaurant. Thank you. Gross, just pure sugar. That's what I drank. I would do that, and we'd pull down the little glove box of the Toyota truck I was driving and make that into our makeshift, bar. And I remember I was in community theater, and I went to the cast party at the Catholic Church afterwards. And there was like a table like we have here, and it was just covered in all sorts of bottles and stuff. And I can't believe I was a senior in high school. And I proceeded to get pretty drunk in the Catholic Church and drive home, but I really don't remember much of the drive home. So that was probably, I would call that a blackout, that I drove home. And suffered painfully the next morning in band class as I happened to sit right in front of the percussion cymbals and the big drums. And so didn't really enjoy that, the hangover part of it. So, you know, like I said, it came and went. I didn't really go out on the weekends a whole lot partying in high school. During my teen years, there was a little upheaval at home, some very financial stressful situations my parents were in, and I remember my dad being quite the little yeller, and I didn't like that. I had a lot of stress during those times, and I would try to take myself out of it by being really busy, and thought that if I just, you know, managed well and kept, you know, just stayed one step ahead of the game, you know, I could have dinner done or do the laundry or do the yard. And we didn't have like one of those little gardens you have, you know, on your porch and a little, now hell, our thing was like an acre of lawn. It was this huge garden. There's always stuff to do out there. So I just thought if I managed well, my dad would be okay. And looking back now, I realized, I didn't realize it, but I was got in the habit of pleasing people. You know, that if I just managed well, everybody would be happy. So that whole trying to control that, which was out of my control, I discovered alcohol took the edge off, and it made me feel more at ease. I left for college. The day after I graduated high school, I went to a Christian college down in the Ozarks, 500 miles away. And it was a work-study program in college. And my parents didn't really have the money to send me to a university, and I didn't feel comfortable getting great big loans at that time. So I went to this college. They have this work-study program where you work 20 hours on campus, and during your several different breaks, you would work 40 hours. So I worked up at the top of the hill where they had a restaurant, and I could get tips, and that afforded me my party money at school. And you couldn't drink on campus, so we would find other places. We would, you know, drink at the lake, drink on, you know, dirt roads, whatever. I remember one time we were out partying, and this guy's driving his Jeep. We go up over this hump, and we're like, oh, what's happening? The Jeep's stuck. And we open our doors only to fall out into the big ravine we were, like, hanging on. And I thought that was fun. I mean, that's not right. That was my first break with the law was in college. Again, out partying. We were past curfew and too drunk to come. Swagging down the big well-lit aisle, whatever it's called, sidewalk down into campus. We went to a hotel room. There was, I think, five of us. Three guys, two girls. And the guy went and got the room, and we all went in. We were going to sleep it off. Well, it wasn't long after, pounding on the door, and I'd go in through it, you know, hello, and I'm all, you know. And, it was very apparent in the ID check that I was underage and had been drinking. And they hauled us all in for underage drinking. And I was so concerned. I knew the guy who was booking us in because I was incidentally studying law enforcement in my first year in college. I knew that the policeman, and I had these barrettes in my hair, and they made me take them out. And I was like, do you know what my hair's going to look like? This is where my concern is, right? And then it's like, oh, shit, when am I going to get the bail money? So I can't call my parents and tell them. And, they kept asking me which guy bought me the beer. Oh, actually, I think I was drinking Jim Beam, and incidentally, it wasn't any of the guys, it was the girl who was with us, so I didn't have to lie, and we were able to get out of that scrape with just like a $100 court cost, and I told the truth, I had been drinking and all that. Well, the judge gave us suspended imposition of sentence, which meant an SIS, which meant if you didn't, crash any or you followed the rules at school, didn't get in further trouble, you were fine. You know, you expunged from your record. So, there was my one night. Well, it wasn't even a night, it was maybe a few hours in jail. But it did deter me. I went back out to the lake. They were partying with that punch. I had Everclear in it. And, I had never had Everclear before. You don't taste it. So, of course, if you drink it like you drink water, or I drank my other thing, I got very sick that night. When most of us passed out, it rained on us. We knew. I have a memory of the guy like laying there and digging a hole and he's hitting it. It was awful. Next day I ended up in the little infirmary at the school because I was dehydrated, but it was dehydration caused from drinking Everclear. Not knowing what I wanted to do in life, still down, I'll let you know when I get there. I quit school after a year, but I stayed down there and I worked. And I moved in with a family and took care of their kids and remarkably wasn't drinking. Not really. Like, I got away from it. Like, I did this ebb and flow thing, kind of like my faith has changed through life. Let's see. So I moved, December, I guess that would have been 85. Yeah, I moved back to Illinois to live with my parents, go to community college. I get my associate's degree in communications just because I could pick anything else, and that seemed like a pretty easy one. I'm working for my parents in the tour bus business. Oh, back up to when I was in high school and they started this business, we had to clean the buses. Now, they said that they have tour buses, and my dad would take trips into the Cubs games, and people would drink and puke, and I don't know what they did at these bars. They sold these little ticker tape things, and they'd be all stuck to the floor. So I'd go back out there to clean it, sweep it. They'd have to turn on the air conditioner. It was hot in Illinois, and I'd add water to that floor, and it just did not smell good. And I thought, I'm never going to drink. And not like this. And sure enough, I just thought it was pretty disgusting. And yet, I ended up drinking like that. So I moved back home to working in the tour bus business. Thought I needed more education, so I moved up to Minneapolis, go to a travel school. I always seemed to pick the roommates who liked to party. My roommate liked to go to bed listening to Pink. Or was it Pink? No, it wasn't Pink. It was, it just wasn't my taste, But it was more of the party scene stuff. So we did parties up there in Minneapolis. And again, not sure what I want to do, so I moved back home. A lot of moving in my story. I went home with the kitchen with it. I never got away or got to where I was comfortable. There was an opportunity to move to Phoenix to manage my parents' office out there. And mind you, I'm only like 21 at this time. So I moved to Phoenix, and that got really stressful because I was ill-equipped to manage an office out there. I mean, I knew how to do payroll and have some other things, but there was a lot of big decisions that I felt responsible for. And so I started smoking cigarettes a little bit. It would give me a little bit of a high. Drinking on the job, I couldn't focus, I was drinking too much. That office eventually closed. I worked in, I didn't want to ask for help. I didn't want to move home to admit defeat, so I stayed out there. And that being a right-to-work state, and no college education, I took jobs that paid not that much. So I ended up working, getting a job at an ice company out there, and worked at Pizza Hut, worked as a slinging drinks at a bar. Sometimes I do all three jobs in the same day. So, dating a guy, my first deep relationship with somebody for a year and a half, and when that when he broke up with me, it broke my heart, and it really threw myself into work and drinking. And if I wasn't working, I was drinking. And I just wasn't happy with the way my life was going. I didn't see any chance for my then ex-boyfriend and I to get back together. So I thought, I'll move again, and I'm going to move to Georgia, and everything's going to be good because I'm going to start over. But about a month before I left there, I had been out one night, probably closed the bar at 1, and I got to be to work at 6:30 in the morning. And I get to work, and I'm doing my thing, and one of the supervisors comes through, and he smells the alcohol, and, well, it was from the night before. So technically, I had drank that day, so it was after 12, and I got fired. And that was the first time I lost a job. Due to alcohol. So, convinced I'm going to make better decisions, I move here. I move in with my sister and her husband. And 2 weeks later, I had a job, and I met the man who became my husband. So all was looking good. You know, we would get together after work. My husband and I, my boyfriend at the time, and you know, we have a few drinks and have dinner, and I joined a tennis team, and I joined a church, and you know, it wasn't, I think because my life was going well, I didn't feel the need to drink heavily, so I still hadn't crossed the line yet, but when emotional distress would pop in, that would be my go-to, because it would work. And I left something out. Back in Arizona, I started having troubles with a lot of pain. I had what would later be diagnosed as endometriosis, and I've had a lot of surgeries for that. And I would use alcohol to help manage for the pain because I couldn't function on painkillers. And I guess back then maybe I wasn't going to the right doctors, but they weren't handing them out for that. I guess, and they used to tell me like it wasn't painful, but let me tell you, it still is. So, I was working, going to PSU in the evenings, going pretty well. My job that I was at, that I really enjoyed, had been bought out by another company, and I had the option to either move to Nashville, or have to find a new job. And, I was hoping my husband was going to propose, so I turned down that offer for Nashville, found a job, and he came through on his end. He proposed to me for that. And a year later, we were married. Right before I got married, I was very stressful at work. We had something, I was working at a nursing home, and we had one of the residents get burned by one of the showers, so the department heads became responsible for taking the temperature of every faucet in that facility on the hour and record it for the state. So I was working probably 14 hours a day, commuting an hour to work and back, and trying to plan this wedding. And by the time family got here, my wedding got here 2 weeks later, I was completely exhausted. I drank a lot at my wedding. I was having a good time, but I was just so happy to make it there and happy to be away from work. And I remember standing up on the stage and leading the Macarena because I had showed everybody how to do it. And I still can, you know. But you know, there's things of that night I don't remember. I wish I did. I remember we didn't want the party to end, so my husband announces everybody come back. So all this booze we had bought comes back to the house with us. All my friends think that's a great idea, so they come back to the house and bring all the food. I know my sister, at some point, I must not have been making sense, and they put me to bed and took off the little thing I had pinned on my head, and I woke up the next morning with the most massive hangover, and from the looks of it, my house, everybody had a good time. I got on a plane. I'm like, here we are, we're flying first class. I couldn't even enjoy it. I guess I had so much the night before. But, I regret not having better memories of my wedding night. Let's fast forward or we'll never get out of here. 1999, I adopted the first of my three kids. And life was going good. I was afforded the opportunity to stay at home and raise my daughter. But about 6 months into her being there, I found it hard to take care of them because I couldn't get around. My pain had gotten so bad. And I thought, well, yeah, I got one of my goals. I have a child. So, I opted for a hysterectomy. And that helped for a while with the pain. And where we lived, it was this little road over in Acworth that was like two dead end roads. It was very isolating. And I know my husband would be like, well, you gotta stay home, make sure she gets her naps. But you have newborns, you know. By the time you feed them and change them, and it's time for a nap again, you can't go anywhere. So we decided to move over to a larger neighborhood with a swim tennis where I could get engaged with other women and get out of myself and get out of my home. And that seemed to help for a while, except I started comparing myself to people in the neighborhood. You know, was I a good enough mom? Was I doing it right? My kids, they're not speaking three languages. I'm not doing it right, you know? And my second child was born in another stressful time, about 8 days after my mother-in-law passed away. And so even though it was joyful having a new baby in the house, it was during a very stressful time in my life. And he was kind of colicky, but it was hard for me to ask for help. And that's throughout my life story, hard for me to ask for help. So I was trying to make it look good, that I had all things going well on the surface. But deep down inside, this need to mask my feelings and cover it up was increasing, and so was my drinking. And I got to a few times where I was taking a drink in the morning. My husband, I'll tell you the first incident. I think this might have been what spurred me into AA the first time. I went out with friends. We took the fur bus to downtown and went club hopping. I don't remember much of it because I guess I felt entitled since I was out of the house that I was going to have a good time. Well, my friend apparently drove me home, and what I do remember is I got in the bathroom and I landed on that toilet so hard it snapped at the base and water was going everywhere. And I had enough wherewithal to lean down and shut off the water to it. My plumbing husband had taught me enough to know that. And I mopped up the mess, but the fact that I came home in that disarray and snapped the toilet, I landed my fat ass on it. It's just amazing. And he's like, you need to get some help. Taking out a problem. So I came in, I came into AA. I think it was around 2004. And I was here. I went to the Founders, and I don't know how to manage that. That's a 1 o'clock meeting. I have three small kids, but I won't say. But anyway, and I took the steps. Again, don't remember much of it. I think there was some sort of weekend where they did like a step workshop. I think I took it in like a weekend. And I graduated. All was good. I got my 12 steps and here you go. So, I did pretty well. But in 2005, I think clearly not convinced I had a problem because it seemed so easy. I remember reading a book that questioned, you know, whether you were an alcoholic and how you, if you just did these simple things, you could manage your drinking. And since I liked what I was reading, I did what they suggested in the book, and I tried to manage it once again. So I was on vacation down in St. George. My dad was along, and he's usually a trigger for me. So I bought a bottle of wine, and I didn't drink at all, and was sitting, and I thought I was cured. And so I continued to drink, and it took a little while to build that back up. But to my recollection, I didn't go right back to where I was. It took me a few years. So back in now we're up to 2013. I noticed I was having my inability to stop drinking. I was taking some drinks in the morning. I was homeschooling my kids. Didn't usually drink before I homeschooled them. Maybe it was after I finally sent a couple of them off to school. I can't remember. But it was becoming more of a daily basis. In early 2015, I was working on my health because I had some autoimmune disorders, and so I went to a functional medical doctor and started taking some tests, and, you know, ooh, my liver enzymes are up. Must be all these other things that aren't working well. How much do you drink? Oh, you know, the typical 2 or 3, several times a week. I wasn't telling the truth. I wasn't being truthful. I look back at this little journal I had, and I wrote, I wrote on March 2nd, I wrote, God has a healthy replacement for old destructive habits. Exercise daily. Get involved at church. Make time with God a priority. Rest. Read. Work in my yard. That was it. I did not have quit drinking on that list. I think I had always written, well, I know I had always written it down. It's kind of like that New Year's resolution where you scratch it out and put the next year on there. I just quit writing it. I just quit writing it because I think I wasn't equipped to face it. So, anyway, I rededicated, I think it was in April, I rededicated myself to baptism. And in June, I told a counselor who I was taking my son to, because I thought he needed some guidance, that I told her I thought I had a problem. And she suggested I go to AA. And I'm like, oh, I'll get to that. I've got a vacation coming up. I'm going back to Illinois, 4th of July. Don't want to ruin that. So I'll go when I get back. So, went to Illinois, and it didn't disappoint. I felt uneasy around the people who love me. I felt uneasy around my family. Dad would get upset because he'd try to manage things, and it wasn't going over his way. So I'd sneak out to the motorhome and throw back some glasses of wine to calm my nerves. And you know, incidentally, at this point, I am hiding some bottles of wine around the house. If I drink the bottle of wine in the refrigerator, I'm quick to run over to the sink and fill it up about yay to look respectable. You know, that's a problem. Got home from that trip. I'm repacking the bus to go out to Texas and got a call from a friend who suggested I needed to have a talk with my daughter. Found out my daughter was pregnant. And I couldn't breathe, and I didn't know how to fix it. I could fix it, anything. That's what I did. I was a fixer. And so I drank a bottle of wine. My husband got home, and I shared with him. And I just didn't know what to do. I knew I didn't have a choice. I had to get my shit together. My family needed me. So I came to a meeting, the AIPAC meeting, and cried like this for days. And I came back
Because in the rooms I saw something I needed. I saw hope. I saw people who were happy and laughing. I had people listen to me and tell me I was going to be okay. Just got strength today and come to a meeting. I received suggestions about working a program, getting a sponsor, and I wanted to get better, and I desperately needed to be there for my family. The time had arrived. I had to quit thinking just about me. And incidentally, I drank for 3 days more because I just, and it wasn't working. It just was something to put in my body. It wasn't giving me a feeling anymore. I wasn't escaping my problems. I had to surrender. And so that Saturday, the 11th, is when I came in and picked up my white chip. I had a temporary sponsor who would tell me I was a miracle. And I didn't feel too miraculous. but I'm pretty sure she was referring to the fact that I made it back into the rooms. And she gave me great direction. And, you know, she was going to be, she wasn't going to be around during the winter time because she lived in Florida during that time. So she suggested I find, you know, a sponsor that I could work with on a personal basis, and I found that. And so I began working the program, and my sponsor would suggest, you know, service work. You know, even early on, service work. So I happened to go to a group conscience meeting only 4 months in, and the secretary's position was coming open. And so I started to become part of a group, part of a family, and I took on that position. But I got through some of the hardest stuff during my first year sober. So I worked through the 12 steps, and on some of those, like, step one, admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That was pretty easy. But then I started to look at that our lives have become unmanageable. You know, for years I thought it was managing. Now, oh, managing, control, those words. Oh, good Lord. I look at myself now and I just shake my head at all the control I thought I had out there. And that if I managed well and did well, all these things in life would work out. And then how disturbed I got when they didn't. And I drank. Shit, I drank if I was happy. I drank if I was sad and angry. The latter years, very angry. Things weren't working out for me, and I could not accept those things. I would get angry. I had a belief system, so believing in a God wasn't a stretch for me. I just never chose to turn my will and my life over to him. And that's what I did in the third step. Doing the inventory, tough but necessary. I got to look, and then doing the fifth step, cried the whole time, 8 hours before sponsor. I walked out of there looking like I'd been in a rocky fight or something. But I felt such a relief of going through the process, at getting at the underlying issue. You know, they say in our book, drinking's but a symptom. There were so many other underlying issues that I got to look at and address and ask God to remove those defaults I have, my defects of character, and work on those lists of people who I hurt. You know, I was selfish enough, didn't realize it, but I was selfish enough to think the only person I was hurting was myself. And I wasn't. I was hurting the people who loved me. I was hurting my kids. I was hurting anybody I thought entitled to yell at because they weren't doing it my way. That wasn't who I was. Let's see. So, working through the 12 steps, then my sponsor took me through the chapter to wives, to employers, and family afterwards. And what we were looking for was the spiritual principles and practical advice that was going to help me with my relationships and with my family. in the family afterwards, on page 133, it says, we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery, but if it comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And I was like, how do I do that? And I had to surrender to it. I had to take action and then sit back and wait expectantly to see what God is going to do for me. Went through that chapter and came up with 27 principles to practice with my family and others. My probably most challenging one was taming of my tongue and my comments. I had to practice a litmus test of six things. And if it could pass these six things, then I could say it. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? Does it have to be said? Do I have to be the one to say it? And does it have to be said now? Man, I would get to five and I'd be like, yes, and then, oh, does it have to be said now? So defeating. Anyway, and how it works, I had this twist of thinking, and I had to learn how to turn it over. I had to learn how to trust and rely on God. For we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him. Does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? You know, the change of perception for me is what this program's brought me. You know, back, I told you about back before when I got sober and graduated. Well, you know, it says in here, I have in page 317 in the story of My Chance to Live, I have yet to find a place in the big book that says, now you have completed the steps, have a nice life. Yeah, this program is a plan for a lifetime of daily living. When I am willing to do the right thing, I am rewarded with an inner peace no amount of liquor could ever provide. When I am unwilling to do the right thing, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. It is always my choice. Through the 12 steps, I have been granted the gift of choice. I am no longer at the mercy of a disease that tells me the only answer is to drink. If willingness is the key to unlock the gates of hell, it is action that opens these doors so that we may walk freely among the living. Willingness and action have seen me through it all with the guidance of a loving higher power and the fellowship of this program. And I also had to, paragraphs I truly love is acceptance. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some place, person, thing, or situation, some fact in my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake, and until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. And unless I accept life completely on my terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. That is my go-to. That and the serenity prayer for me in this program. Yeah, I used to think that alcoholism was like a moral issue until I learned it's a disease. And it's a disease that I can arrest only when I stop putting the thing that triggers it in my body. That means I have to have abstinence on a daily basis. You know, there's lots that happened in my first year of sobriety. My granddaughter was born. My daughter, a few weeks later, went to the hospital with pulmonary embolisms. And I didn't drink during those. I was sober. I was present for my family. Yeah, I made it through the trifecta, you know, the Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's without a drink. That was a big deal. 9 months in, there's something about that 9 month mark on me every year in my sobriety that makes me feel weird, but 9 months in, I'm going to a wedding out in Texas, and I'm just, like, these were my party people that I used to hang with, and it turned out the people we were staying with, they weren't drinking. They weren't even eating gluten, which I had to be gluten-free, so I was really happy about that. But, you know, during the service, I know open bar, free open bar was right behind me coming up. And I was just sitting there praying, God, give me a sign, give me a sign. And they did the reading of the St. Francis prayer. And I was like, yes, I can do this. It's just those little things, those little awakening to the spiritual moments in my program. If I'm not drinking and I'm not thinking about what's best, what's so good for Julie, I'm thinking about others. Did a lot of extensive work with my sponsor. Second year, things are calming down at home, still a little rocky. An opportunity to go on a 12-step call, and I got to see firsthand the pain and suffering I put my family through. But I also got the opportunity to work with that family and explain to them what AA is, what alcoholism is, and a program of action that had gotten me sober and had kept me sober up until that moment. I keep working on acceptance, on the loss of dreams I had for myself and family. But I now see the experiences that I have had give me an opportunity to share with others and to give back. This program's helped me with my parenting, although I'm not a big fan of going through the teenage parenting year sober right now. I'm managing. It's helped me in my marriage. I take responsibility for what I've done, and I leave the responsibility for what my husband does to him. Try to work on disciplining my side. I try to stay out of the greatest enemies of alcoholics, which are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. But thanks to this program, when they pop up, I have a way to work through them. And I don't do it alone. I do it by reaching out to y'all, sharing from my heart in the meeting. And I do it, my daily reprieve is always contingent on my spiritual condition. The things that I do is I get up and before I even get out of bed, as I say, the third and seventh step prayer. I take some time to practice prayer and meditation in the mornings. I go to a meeting. I make a gratitude list. I talk with others in the program about my program. I call my sponsor or my sponsees, and I try to work with them to get out of myself. I try to do service to stay involved. In the beginning, it was reading 86, 87, and 88 upon awakening, because I just didn't know how to get up and do these things. I've been afforded a second chance at life, as long as I keep close to God in this program. Just trying to get through this last one. It allows me to live a life that is blessed and that I didn't earn. I'm there for my family in a way I've always dreamed I could be. And I get to watch my granddaughter grow up. Just last week, she said to me, she'll be 3 in October. And I don't know where, she's in the back seat, and we're driving around, and she said, God's plans for you are perfect. And I go, what? And because I don't want her to see me cry, because it's the powerfulness of that statement. She said, God's plans for you are perfect. And I just went about, and I'm like, how profound the beauty of those words. And I could have missed it all. God has restored my life and made me whole. Thank you.